goodness me, Baz, the season is finally over. I think it almost finished you off, didn't it? You've been suffering a bit with Allegri after Madrid, but overall, the effort put in by everybody there, it came out with a pretty good deal in the end, didn't it, for Davis Cup in terms of the competition, what the players put on the court was tremendous.
Yeah, hi, Barry. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I think we all really enjoyed it. I think overall, it was a big success. I mean, the climax of what happened was nothing short of sensational with the run of Spain, with Nadal, with Roberto Bautista Agut. I just about survived. The last 3 days, I have to say, were tough 3 days. But I guess what I was thinking to myself when I was struggling to get up on the Friday and the Saturday, the people that are in the army, they're having to not sleep for days after days after days. They can get through it. If they can get through it, the least I can do is manage to the last couple of days of the tennis season, which has been long, but I think it's been a great season. So many great stories and arguably one of the best right at the end.
In terms of the Davis Cup week, we obviously went there, trying to go there with an open mind, but obviously we have all enjoyed so many Davis Cup experiences down the years, and this was something very different. Initially, concerns about fans, would they turn up to watch teams, you know, in Spain? Obviously, Spain were going to have a full house every time they played, and enjoyed being on the centre court and having exactly that. But for other nations, I felt that, in a way, the saving grace was that those fans who did come, even if they didn't fill the stands, because they were supporting their country, as opposed to just going to another match on the tour, it was a lot noisier. There was much more atmosphere, even with the numbers around. And obviously, at times, you know, some of the smaller arenas were filled pretty much to capacity.
Yeah, I mean, what I don't know about you, Barry, but what I've tried to do is actually, we talked about it, didn't we, beforehand as a team and as commentators. I think we were 12 of us, so we were a big team. I think we were all mindful of the fact to give it all a chance, to not. Keep going back day after day and thinking, well, this is what it should be. Now, I sort of pressed the rewind button. And for me, what my reservations about the whole new format were, the magic of Davis Cup has always been the home and away ties. That, to me, has been what has really stood out for me, spine tingling, whether it be in Seville, when Spain won 28,000 people against Argentina, whether it be in Mar del Plata, when Spain won in Argentina's backyard, and there are plenty others as well. Amazing Davis Cup ties. Unfortunately, I wasn't in Belgium when Britain beat Belgium to win it for the first time in years. We haven't kind of got that answer, have we? Because Spain were victorious at the end. And Friday night, Saturday night and Sunday night was an absolute sellout. But I do agree with you. I think the small intimate stadiums were a huge success. I think the mistake on certainly, maybe not mistake, but I think what was shown is those afternoon sessions earlier in the week. If you've got 2,000 people, it doesn't matter whether it was Argentina or Chile, because they played one day and actually they were making a racket. But in 12,000 seater stadium, it kind of got lost.
Yes.
And that would be the one thing that for me would be the takeaway next year. Why do you have to have two sessions on the main court? Maybe just have one session on the main court, have an extra court and have a small intimate stadium. And if it's 2,000 people and it's packed, that is far better than having, let's say, 4,000 people in a 12,000 seat stadium. I'm not just saying this for Davis Cup. I've said it for the US Open as well. I don't understand why there's always this clamour for players to want to play at the US Open on the Arthur Ashe Stadium court at midday when there's 3,000 or 4,000 people watching, when you could be playing on grandstand when the atmosphere is unbelievable.
Agreed. The scheduling obviously came in for some fire, quite rightly. I mean, that match between USA and Italy that didn't finish until after 4:15 in the morning, the knock-on effect of a very long day session, and that could have actually been repeated on the other of the courts away from centre court because of the long tie that day between Great Britain and the Netherlands, which then pushed Australia and Belgium's start time to, you know, 2 hours later than originally scheduled. So they are aware, the organisers, of the problems. They've talked about it. They've acknowledged that there are going to have to be some changes made. But because this is still you know, this is a 2-year deal for Madrid, isn't it? So same time next year, they will be back there with the same number of teams, pretty much the same format, weren't they?
Well, the schedule was always going to be a problem. You didn't need to be a rocket scientist to know that starting at 11 in Davis Cup, three matches with a 20-minute gap between singles matches and then a 30-minute gap between doubles matches, it was going to overrun. And as soon as the afternoon session would overrun, the evening session start late, then you had that potential. I'm actually glad it happened. I think it was important it happened because, and I'm glad it happened to the extent it, you know, the poor people that were all involved and obviously the players, it's just not on, you know, to be able to finish at that time. But at least when something as extreme as a 4 a.m. happens, then there is the need to say, yeah, right, we've got to change it. And what the ways around it? I think the only way around it, really, I don't think you can reduce the 18 nations. I think there's two reasons why you can't reduce the 18 nations, Barry, is firstly, it doesn't look good when you've changed the Davis Cup format and then you change it again. Mm-hmm. And I think you'll get strong resistance from the federations because one of the main issues for changing it was that the federations were sold that they were going to make more money. Well, if you reduce the nations, surely that means they're going to make less money because there's less nations. So I think that would be a huge stumbling block. I see the only way around it actually is to have more courts and I think an extra couple of days. And I think if you had an extra couple of days, then I think it would be fairer for some of the nations that really got hurt with the schedule. Canada got lucky.
They did.
Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, Sunday. Britain got stung. Serbia got stung. Britain played their first match Wednesday, as Serbia did play their first match on Wednesday. But I just going to the scoring system, I would be shocked if they didn't introduce the match tiebreak and a sudden death at deuce for the doubles next year. I think there was the acceptance that needs to be changed.
So that would be the same as they have on the main tour?
In the doubles, yes.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. It's a tough one to work out. But obviously now we're coming slap bang up against the start of next year in the ATP Cup. And something has got to give. There were certainly quite a lot said, was there not, by the likes of, you know, Piquet and Haggerty, that we have to find a solution to this somehow. Eventually, the sport, you feel, has got to do that, that there is one all-encompassing sort of international team event annually, not just for the men, but the women as well. And if you could combine all that. But again, as we've talked relentlessly about schedules and vested interests and too many power brokers in the sport, too many different governing bodies, trying to get that all resolved is the ultimate question, isn't it? The ultimate problem that tennis faces.
Well, it's never going to happen because you've got the ATP will look at the Davis Cup, I think, with a little bit of jealousy, actually, because overall it was a success. When you had the climax and the story that the Davis Cup had, and the ATP will be wondering, well, are we going to be able to recreate that? You know, I don't see that's going to happen. I think at the beginning of the year, I think the players will want to win, but I don't think it will be they are playing ATP Cup because they're playing for their country. I think it will be they're playing ATP Cup because they've got the points, they've got the money, and they've also got matches to get ready for the Australian Open. And then if it happens that they win for their respective country of Serbia or Spain or Australia, then that's a bonus. And that will always the magic of the Davis Cup, Barry. And I just don't see the parties coming together. I think would love for it to happen. And they want to change the date. They would love to find a week or two in the calendar. But we've been around this sport for many a year now. And we've always been wondering how they can change or rejig the calendar. And no one's been able to come up with a solution.
No. But when you've got somebody like Novak Djokovic saying on site in Madrid that it needs to happen, somehow it needs to happen, that September after the US Open, that Laver Cup week would be ideal to have a joint event, then you feel, well, maybe the sort of tectonic plates of tennis can ultimately be shifted to create something new. But we could obviously debate this, and no doubt people will debate this wherever they love tennis around the world about how it should be done. But in terms of what we have witnessed, the performances, Baz, let's talk about some of the individuals involved. And of course, look no further than initially to talk about Nadal, because I mean, just the culmination of an amazing year. I mean, the Grand Slams, finishing year in number one, got married in the process of the year as well. I mean, just a wonderful conclusion for him. He put heart and soul into everything as usual, and the rewards he got this time, I think he was even staggered by what he's achieved when you think what he's done in so many years past. And at times we thought, well, would he be playing at this age? And yet here he is doing great things still, wonderful things.
Didn't drop serve all week, singles and doubles.
That's amazing.
Yeah. You're going back to the third set against Medvedev when he was 5-1 down, save match point. Didn't drop his serve again for the rest of the year. Tsitsipas, three sets, the whole of Davis Cup. And he has always been an incredible Davis Cup player since he lost his first match. He's now been able to win, I think it's 31 in a row, singles and doubles, the longest undefeated record of both singles and doubles. I mean, it's extraordinary what he's been able to achieve. And it, you know, it's amazing to think that we've heard for quite a few years, oh, Nadal's no good after US Open. He's a spent force after the US Open. Nadal's no good indoors because he's only ever won one indoor title. And he's shown how he's been able to evolve his game, improve his game. I think he probably would have taken Davis Cup above the O2, but he was very close to winning the O2, I thought. Mm-hmm. If that last result on the Friday night had gone his way and Medvedev had beaten Zverev and Rafa would have got through to the semifinals, I think he would have continued the form that he showed on that earlier on the Friday afternoon against Tsitsipas and carried it through for the tournament. But yeah, that wasn't to be. What was obviously the loss for the ATP finals was definitely the gain for Spain and the Davis Cup.
It was certainly that. But obviously it takes a team ultimately to get you through. You can't rely solely on one player as much as Nadal did. But Roberto Bautista Agut, in a week obviously of huge personal loss with the sudden death of his father, the way the team lined up when he was absent with a gap left for him, the mark of respect, and then to come back and play, I mean, and to win as he did. I mean, just that takes huge character, huge strength of mind to do that. We've always known he's had that, he's shown it on the court, but to do that with all the emotion wrapped up in his, you know, huge loss, is just again, another chapter you'd wish that it had never happened like that. But in a way, the way it did was even more remarkable what he achieved.
I don't know how he did it. And I think Nadal almost said that in as many words. He didn't know how he did it. And probably to a degree, I'm not sure Bautista Agut knew how he did it, because he saw a quote from Roberto saying that, you know, after when he got back, and he was able to see his father for the last time, he was in bits. You know, understandably so. You know, anyone that's had to go through it would probably feel the same thing. But there was something that he felt on the Saturday morning after he buried his dad, that just something told him, I've got to do it. And the force and the power that he was able to get from that moment of something telling him inside, I've got to do it. And he was on the bench on Saturday evening, and there were times where I thought he was engaged on the Saturday evening, and there were times where you thought, yeah, I don't see how he could play on the Sunday. But I think the longer it went on, and with obviously the problems with the Spanish team, and in that situation, as captain, I guess if you're Bruguera, Barry, and you've got to ask your number two player, are you ready? And if he says, yes, I want to play, then you have to take that face value. And what a performance he put in.
He really did. It was absolutely outstanding. To have Canada in a final for the first time, well, that was special. We mentioned it in a way, the lucky draw, in that they started so early in the week and had time to sort of regroup. Obviously, they were without Ogier Aliassime, initially recovering from injury. But I mean, Vacek Pospisil, somebody who really stood up above a ranking after a very tough year for him, and yet to play in the way he did, match after match, to then give Shapovalov the chance to close out tie after tie. I mean, we know at some point, surely Canada are going to become Davis Cup champions, you'd imagine, in the next decade or so, with the strength they've now got coming through.
you'd certainly expect Shapovalov and Ogier Aliassime at some stage to be able to win the Davis Cup for Canada for the first time. But it was a great story, and I had the thought, I think we spoke about it on Sunday night actually, and we sort of threw it out there, who was going to be the surprise package. There was always going to be one player who sort of came through, who surprised everyone and had a golden week. I have to say, Pospisil was not one that sprung to my mind.
No, I mean, I would imagine very few people, but it was quite brilliant to see him play to a level that he's shown at times, perhaps in the past on occasion, but then we've always sort of thought, well, you know, he's never really achieved perhaps to the level he might have done. But there's something about Davis Cup, and that's where it is alive and kicking, isn't it? Still, the spirit of it, that playing for your country, that just gives you that sort of unique cauldron in which to perform. And you're either completely overwhelmed by it, or something in you stirs to such an extent that you produce tennis that you really didn't perhaps imagine you were capable of yourself. And I think of another player who stood up in the week amazingly after the year he's had was Britain's Kyle Edmund.
Yep. Yeah. And it was the right decision from Leon Smith to pick him. I always felt that was the case. I even think we talked about it a couple of weeks ago, because when it came down to it, as I know Cam Norrie was ahead on rankings, but if you wanted a player to go out there in a semi-final and win a match, I felt Kyle was always likely to be able to raise his level. So, yeah, three singles victories for Kyle Edmund, and the three big singles victories for Pospisil, coming out of a tough group as well. They had Italy and the States, and that was the toughest group, and they were able to come through it. And, you know, one other thing that, while we're talking about the groups, one thing was a huge surprise was all six group winners all won both of their matches, because I thought we'd have the scenario with three nations having one win each and it would come down to sets and games.
Of course, Great Britain began their week with Andy Murray playing that incredible match against Telon Griekspoor, which went, 3 hours in duration. But by the end of it, Andy was doubled over. He looked, despite somehow finding a way to win amazingly, and of course, one should never doubt his competitive instincts again on display. But, you know, fitness-wise, he was obviously in a bit of a rough way after that. And, okay, Leon called on the teams he did from then on with Andy on the bench. Tough for Andy in a way that should happen. But perhaps a reminder of, you know, still some way to go. He obviously has just, you know, enjoyed the arrival of his new young son. So he had taken a bit of time out, and perhaps that just sort of caught him out, I think, by his own admission that he wasn't quite in the shape he should have been. But he'll now have the off-season looking ahead to that. What did you make of that day that he was on the court, and where do you think he now is going forward?
Yeah, it sounded like he enjoyed his chocolate.
Don't we all?
Yeah, exactly. And you know what? I had no problem with it. And there was a suggestion, well, a couple of people said to me, yeah, but if you think how Murray's year has been and he's gone from the despair in Australia of maybe never playing again, that actually this should have been the climax of his year, winning Davis Cup. But he has put himself through it. And I think, rightly so, after winning the title in Antwerp and then the birth of his third child, it was always going to be hard for him to get up physically and mentally to be able to be in peak condition. And, you know, historically, any player wants to build up towards such an important competition as Davis Cup or a Grand Slam. And Andy didn't have that. You know, he hadn't played for 4 weeks. I always thought he was going to win that match, because how many times have we seen him win matches like that, even when he's not playing his best? And there was a moment, I think it was a tie break. In fact, I think it might have been the third point from the end when the ball went up.
Yeah.
He hit the lob. Griekspoor had at least one smash, maybe two smashes. And as soon as Murray stayed in the rally, you knew he was going to win the point, and then you knew he was going to win the match. Classic,
yeah,
Murray.
It was. That was absolutely spine-tingling. I was sat a few seats behind the end where he was playing from, and it was just, you know, everybody jumping out of their seats when he achieved that. And to me, Baz, although he only played the one match in the end, it was absolutely the foundation block of what Britain went on to do. Because had he lost that, you know, it could have been a very different story. And although Dan, you know, wasn't able to win a couple of matches, he did get a win in the end. And I also thought, you know, brilliant debut from Skupski, Neil Skupski, alongside Jamie Murray. So all in all, from a British point of view, a very positive experience to have got, you know, as close as they did to the final was a great effort. As we are now sort of reflecting on it, we're back in the UK and coming out, of course, this week. There's been a press preview of it, of the film about Andy's recovery, where he went in terms of what he went through with the rehab after the hip surgery, whether the career was going to carry on or not. It's called Resurfacing, is the name of the film, and it's going to be widely available by the end of this week. In terms of what's come out of that, from some of the press reviews of it, I think it's gone down incredibly well already. But it's also shown some sides to Murray, or what he has been through, not just in recent times, but particularly what he went through as a kid. That really, you get a real feel, I think, of what, you know, how tough that was for him at the time, because obviously he was one of those school kids in Dunblane when that awful shooting happened. And then from that, within a year, his parents ended up splitting up. And then, of course, Jamie went off to play tennis down in England, away from Scotland. So his older brother, who he'd done everything with, goes away as well. So you can kind of see in a very revealing way, I think, what, judging by what I've read about the film, bits I've seen on the trailers and stuff, that it is a real expose. But Andy has never shied away, despite somebody being perhaps a person who, you know, doesn't seek the limelight, but he's very honest when he agrees to talk about things, that how much he does reveal. And I think this will just underline again, you know, what is at the core of the guy.
Yeah, I think people realise that with Andy. Maybe initially they didn't, but he is honest as they come. And he will always have time for people. He will always say hello. He will always ask you how your family is. And as in our profession, Barry, not every famous people do that. You know, sometimes they don't want to talk. Sometimes they might their token hi. But yeah, he's a very warm person. And I think, you know, we've all seen, whether inside the sport or whether it be the public, actually this guy has given, what I mean, 100%, 100% to try and be the best tennis player he can be. And, you know, in the end, you know, the one thing that failed him was his body said no. And he's still been able to find, he's still been able to have an answer, because he is a stubborn so-and-so. And stubborn so-and-sos, if you have a huge amount of talent and you're a stubborn so-and-so, then you often become a great. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, for Murray, he's been in that category in the last decade with Nadal, Federer and Djokovic.
Pretty remarkable, Baz, isn't it, really, that here we are, our final podcast of the season, our podcast which began in January, literally the day that Murray announced that, you know, he was likely to retire at Wimbledon, that the Australian Open was going to be his last thing, that we thought, well, OK, what an amazing career it's already been. And yet the chapters that he's written since his return are a pretty special reading. And hopefully there are many, many more to come. Well, I'm going to let you get away. I think you need a hot toddy or something to sort yourself out a bit with the lurgy that you're still having to struggle with. But Baz, thank you very much for all of that, and have a great off season. As to everybody listening, thank you very much for your support over this year. We've really enjoyed bringing you our podcasts, and looking forward to the next one, whenever that will be. See you in 2020. Bye for now.